Okay. I want to start this class, even though we're waiting for Aviva to come back. But I want to start by looking, I want to tell you my teaching process and how I do it. So the blue sheets that you have are the final product of how I prepare my classes. What I like to do is make a sheet like this, which I don't have one of right now, they're getting copied. I first of all personally, no, I'm borrowing hers for a minute. I personally like to make them on blue or pastels. I read better on blue. It's easier for my eyes. But I also like to make it on a color because then when a student is, you know, brings it home and sticks it wherever, they know that the blue sheets or the yellow sheets are from my class and they're not white that blends in with everything. So I almost always print on a color. So both for me and for handing out. Then what I try to do is I try to make cryptic notes. So if you look at this, yes, you can see the direction that I'm going to take, but you don't know what I'm going to say. I hate it when people read ahead and know what the teacher's going to say, and then you get lost in reading the sheets. So I try to make it so that you can't really tell what I'm going to say. However, I plan it out so that even if you don't take notes, and I do leave enough space to take notes on the sheets, they are meant for note-taking, even if you don't take notes, so even for a Shabbos, I would hand it out like this, but I wouldn't leave all that space. It reminds you of what I said. So I want it to be that you don't know what I'm going to say, but you do remember what I said when you look at it. And then I can also, I just realized I forgot to turn this on. Whatever. I don't know how this one works. We'll use this one. Then I can also use it in teaching as a mashal, lahavdil, for written Torah and oral Torah. That people should understand experientially that what's written hardly gives you any information. Gives you some information, but hardly any information. That you really need the oral explanation that goes along with it, and then it all makes sense. So that's how I make, that's what I have in mind when I'm making sheets like this. The first white sheet that I passed around that doesn't have a number one on it, that you can all just look on together. I just want to show you my process of how I come up with the blue sheets.
We don't have a number one.
So there should be, there's not too many. They're for sharing because unfortunately, and I really thought about this and it was wrong, I'm a little bit of an environmentalist. I hate wasting paper. And so since you don't really need this white sheet, I didn't want to make a lot of copies because it's just going to get thrown away. So can I just hold it for a second? I'll show you how I start. So this is what I do. This is how I start. I take the title of my class, and if there's a blurb, I put that at the top. This is for me and my process. This doesn't make it to a student, but just for you to see my process. I'm using this class to teach you how I teach a class, right? So the title of the class, Teaching Adults, Learn How to Prepare and Teach a Class or Series, Discuss Adult Classroom Management, Consider How to Include Time and Space for Processing Ideas, and How or Whether, and Whether to Include Chavrusa Learning. Okay, so I put that at the top so I know my destination. That's what I want. Usually in a class, I try to think of, first, what is my take-home message that I want to give? So I start at the bottom of the sheet, take-home. So if you look at the bottom of the sheet, my take-home message for this class is, with practice, you can do it and love it, and I have a sweatshirt story. Okay, so that's my take-home message. Okay, so, but I don't want you to know my take-home message, so it's not on the blue sheet. I just have a sweatshirt story on the blue sheet, which will remind you of my take-home message. Right, but I don't want you to know my take-home message before I start. But I'm just showing you the process. Now you do, okay? Okay, but that's now. So now what I did is I started what I want to do. I'm going to have a class. I want to talk about the Uvachain concept, which we'll get to. Make sure there's notes. So I want to make sure that you learn how to do the notes. I want to discuss series with a book, without a book, classroom management, different types of students that you have to manage in a classroom. And then the concept of processing. And then the concept of bringing in other ideas. So I just put down my ideas, what I want in that class. Now I have to organize it a little bit. Can I borrow sheet two? Thanks. Okay, so now this is sheet two. Okay, so I started with that. That's my general ideas. But step two of my personal process in preparing this class is I started with some bullet points. And I made it a little bit more. So I know I want to start with the Uvachain concept, which you don't know about yet because I didn't give the class yet. I'm just telling you how I'm going to give the class, right? How I'm preparing it. And then there's going to be a difference between how you teach a class, a standalone class, or a series. How are you going to teach a series? And then classroom management is a whole section. Processing and chavrusa time is a whole section. And still I have my take-home message, okay? Thank you very much. Whoever does not have the two blue sheets, just... it's coming back. Okay. Then I take that, page 2, and I make it into... Oh, who has my teacher copy?
Oh, I just gave it to you.
Oh, you just copied the teacher copy? Oh, too bad. Okay, so whoever has the white one has the teacher copy, which sometimes I make a little fuller. So the teacher copy in my own process, and so you don't really have the blue sheets, so if you have the one that says teacher copy on the top, make sure you look at somebody else's who has blue that doesn't say teacher copy. So first I make my, then I expand it so that I know what I want it to look like. Yeah, take that.
How many sheets altogether do we have?
Two sheets.
No, white, two blue.
You should not be, if you have two blue sheets, do not take that. That's because there weren't enough copies. Don't take that. Those are blue. They just look white. That's right. If there's not enough copies of the blue, that's it.
You give me two sheets.
Yes, that's correct. You did correct. Right.
It's supposed to be blue.
Okay. So.
Yeah, I know. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing. Except, so I showed you stage 1. I showed you stage 2. Now, stage 3 really is the teacher copy. Stage 3 is when I expanded it into all the points that you have on your blue copies, but I keep notes for myself.
So it's really expanded to
him. Uh-huh. So, but that's for me. And then I clean off my notes, and I just leave the cryptic notes for the students, and then, so I label that one as teacher copy so that I bring it and I know what I want to, where I want to go. And then I just have the more blank cryptic note one for a student copy. So what I'm saving on my computer is teaching adults teacher copy, teaching adults student copy. That's what I have left. So and the rest just goes into the garbage, the first page and the second page that you have in white to look at. I don't save that at all. This is what I save. So now I have my teaching adults teacher copy in front of me. Some of you have that, but it's very similar because I didn't put a lot of notes on here. But it's very similar to the teaching adults non-teacher copy, which is what I should have copied for you guys. But you'll see it doesn't have a lot of stuff on it. Okay, so the first thing that I want to say about teaching adults is a Tzipora Heller concept. And that's the concept of uvachein. Right, so this is a concept of uvachein, and so what? Especially in teaching women, but in teaching all adults. There has to be an uvachein message. So what? How did this class make me different? So that's why you start with your take-home message. What's going to be your uvachein point that you're going to make when you give this class? So you have to think of that in the beginning because you have to know, sof maaseh b'machshavat tchila, you have to know where you're headed, right? Begin, as Covey says, the same thing as in L'chad Avdi, begin with the end in mind. You have to have a destination. So start with your destination and then work back. So that's uvachein. But uvachein means something else also. There's a huge difference between masculine learning and feminine learning. I teach feminine learning. That doesn't mean that women can only do feminine learning, and it doesn't mean that men only do masculine learning. But the basic paradigm is masculine learning is lishma. So anybody who knows about communication between the different styles of male and female communication, here is a paradox for us Jewish people, okay? We know in general, women talk to connect, right? So we might talk about nothing. What did you wear? And what did you do? And all these things that really is about connecting, hearing our voices and exchanging words in order to connect. We also talk to exchange information, but there is a lot of talking to connect. Men, in general, talk to exchange information to get to a point. But when it comes to learning Torah, it's exactly the opposite. Men learn to connect. Women learn for a destination. They learn to get somewhere. And that is the major difference between the way men learn and the way women learn. Men have to learn all the time. All the time. They're allowed to take a break for parnasa, for sleep, for rejuvenation, for family. But basically, they have an all the time chiyuv to learn. Women do not have an all the time chiyuv to learn. Women have to learn for two reasons. One, to know what to do. Two, to desire to do it. Those are the reasons that women learn. So you have to learn enough halacha to be able to keep Shabbos, kashas, everything that you need to be able to keep. You have to know what to do. So you have to learn enough for that. Then you have to be able to desire to do what you're going to do. That's where all the space is for women's learning. Mazal in Morocco 150 years ago did not need one single shiur to desire to do it. That's just, she needed to learn what to do. She learned it in the kitchen from her mother. She didn't go to school. And that was it. That was her whole life's learning. And Bela and the shtetl, too, 300 years ago, wasn't going to, she didn't have tzenarena yet, even. Like, there wasn't anything extra for her. She learned halacha from her mother. Done. Maybe a few conversations here and there. But today's woman, and throughout history, there's different women, different paradigms. Today's woman has a ton of space for desire to do. Some women need a lot to desire to do. Some women need hardly anything. Some women need a fluffy shoe or just like nice stories, and they're all about inspiration and they love it. Some women need Gemara to be able to desire to do it. And that's where there is space, is anything from total fluff to really deep learning to a little bit, 10 minutes a day, 10 minutes a week, 10 minutes a month, 2 hours a day. Each woman has to know herself. How much does she need to desire to do it? That's uvachein learning. Know what to do, desire to do it. That's the feminine model. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on
uvachein?
I never heard this.
So that's just that Tzipora Hellerich talks about the difference between feminine and masculine. I mean, she didn't give this whole spiel, just that's what her word, that she teaches uvachein. Uvachein means, and so what?
That's what it means.
That's what it means. And so what? Uvachein. But it's a dot, dot, dot. Right, and so we fill in the blank. It always has to be an and so at the end, never a lishma. Right, women don't learn lishma in general. If they need to learn lishma in order to desire to do it, then they could. But in general, feminine model learning. So the reason why I said feminine model is because I have personally found, I teach men and women, many, many men today, particularly Bala Tshuva, but FFBs too, it turns out, need to be inspired, and they need to feel something different when they get up from a class, especially if they're in the working world, but even if they're in the learning world, very often their learning doesn't change them, and they need to be filled with, and so my learning means I should, whatever, grow, move, do. I mean, that's the whole Musser concept, and this is not a whole class on all learning, but that's why Musser, in learning, not learning, the whole controversy, you guys can fill in the blanks on that. So, okay, so now let's talk about specifically two different types of preparation for teaching. Teaching a standalone class versus teaching a series. Teaching a standalone class is much harder because you have to have a whole package and it's more of a lecture type of a thing. I personally prefer to teach a series or a sit and schmooze kind of class. I do very well with questions, my own personal style. I know myself, so it helps to know yourself also. Some people, it's interesting, I just gave a Shabbaton with Lori Palatnik. In Mexico. So in Mexico, most of the women speak English, but as a second language. You have to slow down so that they can understand what you're saying and also choose words differently so that you're not using too high a vocabulary that they won't be able to access. It's not easy. You have somebody in the back translating, so there's also a distraction if you're a little ADD as a teacher. So then somebody in the back translating can be a distraction, but you know that somebody has to translate for the people who can't really understand the speed or the vocabulary that you're using. Most of the people can understand, but also one thing that happens is you tell a joke, and they get it a minute later. So you're already into the next concept, but then they all start to laugh. So Lori said, don't you find that distracting, that you're in the middle of a presentation and you're bop, bop, bopping along. She's very more boppier than me. So you're talking along, and then all of a sudden, like, they have a question or they get the joke later, and it's distracting. For her, it's very distracting because she has a class that she gives. So she knows her mahalach. She knows how to get there and where she's moving through. I'm much more interactive in the moment, and so I don't find that particular thing as distracting. I actually find it very helpful to get questions for people.
Okay, so I knew you were going to answer me. If so, do you find that you often don't get through your outline because the questions kind of take the class as a...
That's where the classroom management comes in. I do sometimes find that, but in general, if I have an outline, which I don't always make, but I find that very helpful for me because it keeps me on track, especially as an ADD teacher. I can go in a million directions, and then I don't make the point that I wanted to make. So, but I don't find that. My husband's an attorney. So he was sworn into the Supreme Court. He's able to argue a case in front of the Supreme Court, which is an honor for attorneys. So I went with him to Washington when he was, for that ceremony of being sworn in to the club of lawyers who can argue, not that he ever has, it's just a thing, the club of lawyers that can argue a case before the Supreme Court. So they explained some of the kinds of questions that the Supreme Court justices will ask. So I thought about, like, it's helped me as a teacher just to think about different types of questions that are there. So there are point of information questions. A justice actually doesn't understand what the lawyer is saying, so they'll ask a point of information. But I never heard this phrase before. He said sometimes there are questions where the Supreme Court justice will lob a meatball at the lawyer. Something, what does that mean, lob a meatball? Is that like trying to hit him with a tomato? No. It's a question where the justice has rachmanis on the lawyer and realizes the lawyer is not expressing himself correctly. And so asks a question to assist the lawyer in better explaining his concept. So that's not usually what you get from a student. However, very often I find the questions very helpful because usually the student is saying, basically by their question, you're not explaining this 100% to my satisfaction, for me to be able to explain, and possibly there are others in the class that also don't get it. Could you please answer this? It's not always a point of information. It's a bring more out of you kind of a question, and I find that very helpful. I like that dynamic interaction for that reason. Okay, so preparing the one-time class, it has to be a whole package with a destination. You don't get to make up the points that you miss in a series if you don't get to your destination. So no problem, you have next class, right? But in a one-time class, you've got to do it. So title, right? So that's your first note on the everybody else's blue sheets. Oh, create vision. So I had create vision. So that is your sof ma'aseh b'machshava tchila. You have to think first before you go. Begin with the end in mind. So create your vision. What do you want your class to look like? And I find it very helpful then to use a title to capture that. Especially in something like this, in a conference or whatever, so a title and a blurb. If you come up with a blurb, that little definition of what the class is going to be. So especially for a class like this where you thought of the title or thought of the concept a few months ago, and often it's a more creative title. You know, when I send out my speaking topics to people, I have all kinds of titles. You know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and Jews are from Sinai. Okay, so what could that class be? A million different things, right? You could teach whatever you want under that title. So I taught it once. I had in mind what it was. But now when somebody asks for it, so they're intrigued. What are they intrigued about? I don't really know. It really helps to have a blurb. If you have a blurb, even though you created the title a few months ago, you know where you're headed with the class that you're supposed to teach. So that just helps. It helps you create a destination and remember your destination if you can write just a few sentences about what your title is going to be. So create your vision. Then begin with the end in mind. Make sure you have a take-home point. What is it going to be? I just want to see where your notes differ from. Write notes. It's okay. I can read upside down. I'm happy. I'm a knight. You have your notes. You want your notes to be cryptic, that they shouldn't be able to read ahead of you, something like this. So we already talked about that. And then...
So is that if you're giving notes to the class?
Yes, if you're handing out notes like this. So for me, I like to do this because this just keeps me on track. And then I know where I'm headed in the class. It's very easy to go through it. It takes a little more effort to prepare, but it's really such a great aid for a teacher. Then you know exactly where you're headed. You just go through it and you add in all the stuff that you want to add in. So your notes, you want to make sure that they're cryptic, but then fill in the blanks for yourself. So that's what that fill in the blanks is. Make your teacher copy so you kind of know where you want to go with it.
If you have sources, let's say like you're doing something inside with like, I don't know, yeah, excerpts from Chumash, Gemara, etc. Mm-hmm. Would you say to keep the notes like along with the little pieces of the sources, or would you say to keep the sources in a separate sheet?
I do separate. So first of all, for Seamus purposes. So you can put the sources in Seamus if you need to, or your student can put them in Seamus and they can still keep their notes, right? So, and then they can file them separately too.
You don't find the notes with the sources?
No, so then I would. Then I number them. So I'll number the sources and then I could put on the note, you know, see source one, uh-huh. Just on the notes so that you can do that. So you can refer it back to each other, but to keep it separate for Seamus purposes. Because a lot of times people, especially in a crowd that's sensitive, a lot of times people will look at the sources for the class and give them back to you. Because they don't want Seamus. They don't want their responsibility. So then you have a list, you have a pile of Seamus left. So you want the notes to be separately write-onable for people.
And do you always use sources? Because I find like very beginners get distracted by them.
I do not always use sources.
Okay.
I do not. And here is one thing that I can tell you that's been very freeing for me. 2 points. One is you do not have to be Pesach Kron and know exactly the page in the Gemara that quote was from. You can say, in the Gemara it says, our sages say, tradition teaches us, our mystics tell us. These are fabulous phrases, right? That totally free you up. And plus, you don't make stupid mistakes. Like I heard somebody recently say, in the Gemara it says, Chanoch Lenor Al Pi Darko. And I'm thinking, no, it doesn't. It doesn't say that in the Gemara. It says that in Mishle. And then you get stuck on that teacher's mistake, and you're thinking, really? Right? So it's really, like, sometimes it really helps to just say, our sages say, you know, our teachers tell us, tradition teaches us, our mystics say, the deeper sources say. Right? These are great ways to just, right? And that also helps with the whole Orthodox problem. You don't have to say, you know, Orthodox anything, and the Orthodox tradition is. So, and I want to give one more point about that. I taught for Melton for a year. It did not work out for me because Melton is a literacy program, and I'm an inspirational speaker. And I tried to be true to the mission of Melton, which is to give literacy, but I realized that what I like to do is connect with somebody's neshama. And that's not the job of a Melton teacher. It's just literacy. So I really had a hard time. I was teaching a graduate class for people who finished the program on Yosef. So I was teaching Chumash. And I tried to find other sources. I wanted to be able to include non-Orthodox sources. So I brought that up to somebody in a Melton teacher's training course in Yerushalayim. I said, I'm trying to find some non-Orthodox sources to include. She said, well, what sources are you using? This is a conservative person. I said, well, you know, I'm Rashi and Midrash and, like, you know, but I'm trying to find. She said, what do you mean? You're calling those Orthodox sources? How dare you say those are Orthodox sources? Those are Jewish sources. Those belong to the entire Jewish people. Don't think you can claim those sources just because you're Orthodox. I'm thinking, right. They're just Jewish. They're not Orthodox. Just because Rashi would probably identify himself today as Orthodox doesn't mean that I need to identify him as Orthodox. I could just say Jewish. These are our Jewish sources. They belong to every Jew, no matter how they believe or what they think or feel. Jewish sources, no need to go out of that and try to find some kind of poetry that discusses sibling rivalry that has to do with, you know, and make it fit in. Forget that. You know, I can look into the Jewish sources. We have enough.
Just one point. As I find that whenever I'm teaching a class, I feel like it's so much stronger. It comes across so much stronger if I actually do have the source. Like, I recently gave a class on covering your hair, and I felt that it was so much more real when I was able to, like, you know, show the Chumash, what was written in the Chumash, what's written in Gemara, and, like,
absolutely,
and give those sources. But sometimes that really gets you,
yes,
bogged down because you really have to
find, exactly, it. So you have to, that's why you need to know your destination. Right? That's very important because absolutely sources are important. And you want to connect people in with a source if you're trying to give them something that will be there. So are you just about inspiring in this class? What's the goal of the class that you're giving? Is it straight up inspiration? So maybe you don't need so many sources, or maybe just one pasuk here or there, something that people could take as a mantra with them. If you're trying to teach something in depth, hair covering, and your goal is hair covering and why you should do it, that's your take-home message. This is not a survey of hair covering in the world. This is, I'm trying to convince you to cover your hair, right? You're not putting that on the bottom of your sheet, but for yourself you are. Try to convince to cover head, right? That's your goal, right? So in that goal, it can't be all your thoughts. It has to be why it's worth it, and that's how you're going to evaluate your sources. You do want to bring people through a process, especially because you want to be able to tell them it's a deraisa, but the deraisa derives from a pasuk that doesn't make it seem like it's a deraisa. So you do maybe want that source, and plus some other things from rabbinic tradition. Rabbinic tradition is either Talmud or Midrash, or, right? You can say, our rabbi say. So, but you want to be able to show that inside. So you can, for that particular thing, especially if you're dealing, let's say, with modern Orthodox, especially if it's small O, small M modern Orthodox, not Bashita modern Orthodox, right? So then you want to be able to show the progression exactly to be able to convince them that this is in fact halacha and not just what some Shaitel Macher dreamed up, that we should all be buying Shaitels from them.
I just feel that just like one thing is like I just find this in teaching in general. For sure, even if people are coming from a more secular background, that the sources, like if you could prove it in the source, anything related to halacha just gives it so much more validity.
Yes.
You could be so inspirational and make them feel like it's like all delicious and wonderful,
right,
to be from and to keep the, but like when halacha is clear.
Exactly. So that's your point there.
Right.
If it's halacha, bring a source. If it's a shkafa, it helps to say who or where they can find more information. It's so often people want more. But you don't necessarily want to bring them inside a whole long hashkafic source, depending on the size of the class also and the conversation ability in the class.
That's
just want to say that Owen Marcus, when he was talking about teaching class, and now Alistair was talking about how he has maybe a whole list of sources that he uses, and he doesn't necessarily list them in order. And he might only refer to it once or twice, but it also teaches them that there's a lot of other stuff out there that then they can go and explore afterwards when they take it home. Right. And you don't necessarily feel like you have to necessarily use all the stuff out there. Mm-hmm. You do touch upon it, you don't touch upon it, but it's rooted in something. It's not just what I'm saying, or it's not just
right.
Good, so
don't right. 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 That's
you
good.
You come across all these different things, and you'd like to include them, but like you, it doesn't necessarily get you to your goal. It's also a good place to put it.
Good. Let me just throw this question in the back. No? Okay. Gila.
I think it also depends on the audience, because some people find sources intimidating.
Yes.
You know, they're not going to. You can give them sources, but they just find it awful.
Right. So some people find them intimidating. Some people find them boring. So you have to know your crowd. That's important. And some people love it. Some people feel like they got nothing. You just gave them fluff if you didn't give them a source. So you must know your crowd and who they are. So, right. No sources for this because, I don't know. Did Moshe Rabbeinu ever, like, give hadracha on how to create a shir? Yeah. Right.
People will know this is, you know, these word inspirational.
Right.
Know it's probably not going to be. And what, based on how you advertise it, you can.
Absolutely, right. So that way people can self-select also who wants more text-based, who doesn't want text-based. So that's important too. Okay, so now you filled in the blank spots in your notes for your own self. That's part of your process. And then the final step in preparing this class, not really a final step, it's the second to the last step, run it through in your mind. So just go through the class and think, okay, so I want to open up with this, I want to move on to this, I want to move in that, I want to go in that direction. One person told me, I'm just giving you this an idea because I haven't tried it, but he uses a house in his picture. How do you bring him in the door? Which rooms in the house will you go to? What information is in each room? And so he knows how to walk through the house and bring you back out the door, but he uses that. So I'm just giving that to you as a tool in case you want something like that for how to run it through in your mind. But that might be helpful to store information in different rooms, so you make sure you hit the different rooms. Someday maybe I'll try working with that. Okay, the final step, which I didn't put here because I put it in the end, is daven. So important to daven, right? So depending on the class, I have different tefillos that I say. But I say Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit a lot because I want to help build people's homes, right? Mizmor Shir, is that 40? 30? 30. It's 30. So I say that one. Or if I'm feeling worried about it, so I say 20. Yan Chashem, right? Hashem should answer me. But in general, almost for everything, whether I'm making a phone call to call somebody or walking in to teach or having a conversation with a kid that needs help, or certainly when it's a difficult situation, I say this pasuk, Hashem Svatai Tiftach Ufi Yigi Tilatecha. Why do I say that? Because, and I say it in Hebrew, Hashem Sifatai, Asafa is your mouth. So usually we translate that as, please Hashem open my lips, that my mouth should say your praise. But Asafa is a boundary or a border, like Sfat Hayam. So I say, Hashem, I am only so big, but I need to be bigger than I am right now in order to accomplish this mission. So please open up my borders and boundaries. Open it up, because I have to flow more than I have before. I have to reach more places. And with that energy, that additional flow, please help me channel it into Ufi Yigiti Latecha. But please open me up to be more than I ever have been, because that's what I need to be, the right kli for you right now. So that's my tefillah.
Also another pasuk that I was taught by a woman who teaches in Cleveland this year for many, many years. She said the pasuk in Mishlei, the Adam Arkeleit Mehashem Anel Lashon. So Mehashem Anel Lashon means that we can try to answer the questions the best we can, but it's only a grapple how our Anel Lashon will be. So she taught me to say that pasuk
right
before class, especially with the question and answer, but really any
absolutely. And I find as a teacher, there's so much Siyata Dishmaya, both in my learning, like sometimes I'm learning a way to prepare for something or I'm just contemplating and I have a question. And then I go to hear the Pirkei Avos share that Shabbos and the Rav is speaking exactly about my question. He just arranges this. And it's happened so often now that I just ask Hashem on my way walking there, hey Hashem, I'm teaching about whatever this week. Could you please give me information that fills in this place? And he does. It's unbelievable. All the time. But not just that, here's a balancing tip. As a busy wife and mother and a busy person in life, I do not have enough time to learn properly. It's just not there. So I ask Hashem in Chonein Hadat. I say, please, Hashem, give it to me for free. I want to be your kli. I want to teach, but I just need it for free because I don't have enough time to learn it. So please give me the information for free. Please give me my memory. It should work well. Please help it come out of my mouth appropriately. Like, I just need it for free. Please give it to me for free. I also spend time learning, but I ask, please, straight up free. I just need it because I'm teaching and I don't have enough time to learn everything I have to learn. So I just need a free gift, please. And Hashem does. Sometimes I was shocked when I hear something come out of my mouth. I'm like, "Why? Oh, I didn't even know I knew that." But it turns out I don't know that because I can't remember it later. I didn't acquire it. I wasn't kona it. So it's not my Torah. It was a free gift for that class. But it's not necessarily a part of who I am as I build myself and my own Torah learning. It's a gift for the class. So now I'm starting to change that tefillah. Please help me have it for free and please help me remember it forever. So I see that's a constant relationship you got to develop here. Okay, so that's giving the class. Now a series. So a series, there's two ways to give a series, with a book or without a book. All right, so let's just do with a book quickly. So right now I'm teaching Sefer HaChinuch. I've taught a lot of books. So I'm teaching Sefer HaChinuch. I taught Derech Hashem. I taught Tamar Devorah. Can I teach any of these books? Not really. Do I have enough information? So I used to be, you weave yourself between, or at least I weave between, the self-confidence to teach and the total, how could I possibly ever be a teacher, kind of a thought, right? So certainly with Tamar Devorah, I got it way over my head. And like that was a 13-CD series of Yaakov Haber. I figured, no problem, I'm all set. I'll read, I'll learn a little bit, I'll listen to the tapes. I'll give it over. My class is on a much lower level. Then I find out, because I hadn't read the whole book before I started to teach the class, that the second half of the book is really hard, way over my head, and the 13-CD series completely leaves you off in the middle, right? So I decided, I came up with a new word for this. I now lead guided explorations. I'm not necessarily teaching it. So that way I'm not saying to people, I'm an expert in this text and I can definitely teach it. I say, I have Torah knowledge, which I will share and bring to bear on our guided exploration through this material. So, and I'm not saying this out loud, but just this is what my kavana. I know more than you about this subject or about Torah in general. So as we move through the text together, I'll be able to be the leader. But I don't know everything. For sure, I don't know everything. And there are places where I get to and questions that I get where I say, that's a fabulous question. Now, I just gave a whole class on the Omer, and somebody asked, it couldn't possibly be coincidence that we have a period of mourning. If this is such a happy period, and we're so excited, counting up to get the Torah, so why did Hashem make it that the plague should be right now? Why do we have this overlay of mourning? It's not just that we're mourning coincidentally at the time of our excitement counting up to Sinai. Why is that? And I thought, gosh, I never really thought about it. Yes, we have that, and we try to have the simcha and the mourning at the same time, but I never really thought about why did Hashem choose this exact time for that? And so I just had to say, I don't know, that's a fabulous question. I'm going to look into it, and next time you invite me back to Mexico, hopefully I'll have the answer. But you don't have to say you know everything. Okay, so with a book, learn the book. Pays to read the whole thing. Am I going to read all of Sefer HaChinuch before I start to teach that class? I'm not. So at least learn ahead quite a bit or, have an idea of what most of the 613 mitzvot are. I've done whirlwind tours of the 613 mitzvot, like a six-week series where I've chunked them together and done a whirlwind tour so people can have an overview of the whole thing. So I had that background. And I've looked up things in Sefer HaChinuch a lot, but haven't read the whole thing, or certainly learned the whole thing, but learn what you need to learn to feel comfortable that you could lead, at least you could be the guide on the exploration. So get yourself to a place where you feel like you can be a guide, not somebody who knows everything. Then discern. Discern the amount that you think you can cover in a session. That takes a little practice. You may make up a sheet like this and find you only covered half. And that might end, if you're doing a series, no problem. You can start in the middle next class. But you do need to learn approximately what your style is and what their absorption level is so that you figure out eventually what you can teach in the amount of time that you have.
How important would it be to complete a book with a person?
That's an excellent question. With one person or with a whole group?
Either one.
With one person, probably not as important. But with a whole group, especially if you're leading them first a few years, it is important, I think, to help people have a sense of achievement. So making a siyum on a book is a very nice thing, and you invite them to share Divrei Torah, invite their spouses, their close friends, have a suda where it really is a siyum, even if it's a siyum on Tomer Devar or Derech Hashem or whatever, or Pirkei Avot, right, where you like sit together and say a sense of accomplishment. There is something there that is important to bring somebody to a place of, especially in the, when they're learning, and especially for women. We never get a chance to really, we rarely get a chance to feel like I finished something, right? So that's one reason why a bar mitzvah is a big occasion, and when a wedding is a big occasion, you know you didn't finish, but it's like a real milestone. I finished their main parts of their childhood. I finished, you know, getting them to adulthood. When do you get to say I did it? And we never can get smicha, so there's never even that milestone. So for Baalei Tshuva, Baalot Tshuva, they don't get that like thing either. So like it is important to give somebody a place where they can mark I accomplished something. So it could be assume finishing a book, or it could be that's why the Jewish University or there's other programs like that, Melton, a 2 or 3 year program and you get a certificate of completion, a graduation ceremony. That's important. Because even though it's the same information you would have gotten just traipsing along learning for 3 years, however, if you have the Maya program, 100 hours of learning, or Melton, or Jewish University, or whatever it is, when you finish it, you got a certificate. You accomplished something. People want a sense of accomplishment. Okay. So with the book, and now map, right? So map out what you think you're going to cover. Is this a 6-week series? So map out how much you're going to cover in 6 weeks and just chunk it up so that you're ready. Is it until you finish the book? That could take a few years. Derech Hashem took 4 years. Right, so but we got through the whole thing. But so then I didn't map it out. I just and that class was willing to go as long as it took to finish it. So so it just depends on what you.
You had the same group for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I did. Yeah. I mean, people came and left, sure. But the same core for 4 years. Yeah.
What different people came and left brings me to my question is, I find that it's, sometimes it's not only a series or a standalone. It's really both women, especially because even though it's a series. So many women are, especially young mothers with young children, but they're coming, they're going. So I find it's like you have to be a sort of both, and you don't have such a great sense of continuity because you have to make each class within a series and so standalone.
Right.
Anyway, any thoughts on
that? Yeah, so that depends on the series. Some series you cannot invite drop-ins, regular drop-ins. I mean, they could come. They could start the series in the middle, but they can't really drop in. They could drop in to see if they like the style, the dynamic. But for teaching Derech Hashem or Tomer Devorah over 2 years, you cannot have people who just show up once a month. It doesn't work because there is a continuity to that. So you can have somebody start in the middle and they missed a lot. And then that's part of the classroom management when they ask something basic that you've already dealt with. You know, why would God do that to us then? And you are spent all 2 months on suffering and Hashgacha Pratis. And so then you can say, great question. Let's meet after class. Move on. Right? But that's not something you answer in front of the other students. It's going to bore them. So, or you catch them up. You say, I'm willing to come a half an hour early for the next 4 sessions to try to catch you up to where we are now. Something like that. But yeah, for some things you can't. And that's part of classroom management too. What is your class and what responsibility do you have to your class? I give you a speck more rachmanis for a high school principal that rejects a student. Just because sometimes it's really not a good fit. And you just can't have them in your class. And that's okay. Occasionally, as you become stronger as a teacher, sometimes you can say, this is not the right fit for you. Why don't you join me in that class that's more topical, not in this class, which is a longer study, something like that. But you have to have an option to send them to. But sometimes you have a responsibility to the class where you just have to say it's not a good fit.
So how would you do it? Would each person have a book? And
yeah.
Then you read what? Like, 1 or 2 pages and then discuss it, or you read a chapter and then discuss it?
Good. So I would say there's probably three of the ways, not three, so I'm working on that too as a teacher, not to say there's 3 ways to do it. 3 of the ways that I know to do it are, because there's probably more than that. One is you read the book paragraph by paragraph together. So for instance, I'm learning Bridging the Gap with a group. So Bridging the Gap is a fabulous Musar book. I love, love, love it. Totally into it right now. That we read out loud, literally, paragraph by paragraph and discuss. Sometimes we get a whole page done before we discuss. And we usually get, I'd say, 2 to 5 pages per hour done. So that's method number one. Method number two is read around in the text so that you have already read ahead. And you know what you want to share, right? So let's say for a chinuch, I don't read every mitzvah out loud. I list the mitzvahs that I'm going to cover. But sometimes there's a very important paragraph in the mitzvah. So I don't want to explain the whole thing about why you can't break the bone of the Korban Pesach. But in that mitzvah, number 16, it talks about ha'adam nifal kafiv pu'ulatav, that we are shaped according to our behavior, and that's why there's so many mitzvahs. That's a very important paragraph and needs to be read inside. So the mitzvah, really, do we give a Korban Pesach? Do I need to really explain the whole thing? Not really. But that concept and that mitzvah, that paragraph needs to be read out loud. So I've read ahead, and I pick the paragraphs. I just make a little mark in my text, the paragraphs I want to make sure are read out loud, and otherwise I just offer a conceptual thing about it. So that's number two way, read around. And number three is more book club style, homework, which doesn't work. It depends. If it's a small group that really is motivated, maybe you can do homework. But where you say, we will be discussing this chapter, and you hope that people read that chapter on their own so that the hour that you have together is discussing that chapter, not reading that chapter. In general, I have found people do not have time in their lives. So it's very difficult to assign any kind of homework, even homework of think about this over the course of the coming week. They don't. So, yeah. I haven't, but I know that that can be successful. So that's where people know that they're signing up for read the book, come discuss it. There's no point in going to the discussion if you didn't read the book, right? So, but and I know that's been successful, and I think that'd be an interesting conversation to have about people who have done that successfully.
Sorry, one more
question. No problem.
So with number one, so you read a paragraph, and then you're going to talk about that paragraph, right? Like you personally, or you just end up being like a discussion?
So in something like that, it's much chummier. You can't do it in a group this size, for sure. This is a, let's say, 5 to 10 person, 3 to 10 person type of a study circle. Yeah, so you read the paragraph out loud. You might go around, and then you'll see, as people are reading, you'll be able to pick up on where explanation needs to be had. Yeah, so you flesh out those important points. Yeah, because sometimes because you bring more knowledge to the text than they have, so you understand what the author's talking about. There is a hamevin yavin, you know, the one who understands, understands. They understand something from reading that paragraph. You understand more.
Yeah.
So that's what you're going to share, is the more right there. And that's what connects them with you. Okay, so that's as a series with a book, without a book. Title and vision, just like a standalone class, it's very similar to a standalone class. This is a series, but it's without a book. So title and vision, divide into the chunks so you know how long your series is going to be. It's a 6-week series, it's a 4-week series. What do you want to teach? Learn up the sugya, however much you feel like you need to learn. Write your notes and fill in the spaces. It's basically the same thing as a standalone, but it's more casual. Sometimes it helps to have a little gimmick. I did a Shalom Bayit series. I had 4 weeks. Aish called me. We teach Shalom Bayit. Fine. Okay, so now how am I going to do that? Like, I have to decide, what are my chunks? What am I going to focus on? So I used Rabbi Abitan Zatzal's Shalom Bayit Shalom class. Not class, vort, that he gives at a Shavar Brachas, gave at a Shavar Brachas. So I just did, it's on Shalom. How do you make Shalom? You look at the letters, Shin, Lamed, Vav, Mem. Shin has a dot on one side or the other. Shalom is you keep one eye open or the other, but not both. Lamed, you look at the Lamed, stands straight up or bends over backwards, right? So sometimes you have to know when to stand your ground, sometimes you have to know when to completely bend over to accommodate. Vav, either appears in the word or doesn't appear but is still heard. So you have to know when to be on the scene and when to work from behind the scenes. Mem, could be open, could be closed. You have to know when to keep your house open, when to close the door. And so, but I did, what I did was 4 weeks, a letter, a class. Right, so I gave the vort first. Abitan. Abitan. Chacham Asher Abitan is his name.
Is it in a
state? No, he was my rabbi in Long Beach, Long Island. So, I have the series that I gave on tape, but that's a nice vort. It's a great vort you can develop yourself for a shower, for shower, like just to have in your back pocket. It's a fabulous quickie. So you'll make it up yourself as you go along, but basically it's based on the letters. You look at Shin, Lamed, Vav, and Mem. How do you create Shalom? Look at the letters. Shin, right? And if I do it for a shower, because I've done it for a lot of bridal showers, it's nice. Just bring the letters, and you have people get up, and they can hold the letters for you, right? So the shin has a dot on one side or the other. which teaches us about our eyes. We have to have one open or the other, but not both. Benjamin Franklin said, go into a marriage with your eyes wide open, but stay in the marriage with your eyes half shut. Same concept. Right? So that's the shin. Lamed also is the only letter that completely changes its shape like that, that can stand straight up or totally bend over backwards. So you just continue talking about that, however long you have to discuss accommodation or standing your ground and the balance in that. Vav is either in the word. You can either see it or it's still there, but you don't see it. Right? So you have to know when to be felt and when to be seen. Right, when to work from behind the scenes, and the mem, it comes in two shapes also. It's open or closed. So you have to know when to be open and when to be closed. So you can either use it as a whole long thing and how to give hadracha in what to achieve, or just to say, these are the things you're going to need to figure out over the next several decades while you're married, you know, how to create the balance in this. So you can think of something like that that helps you chunk it up, or you can just decide what concepts you want to do, communication and relationships and in-laws and, you know, whatever. You'll do it that way, but it's nice to have a theme for each class, kind of.
When you're giving a class, let's say, like on Shalom Bay, it's not like necessarily on a sefer. How do you prepare? Like you usually
I read up a bunch of different sefer. I read what I want to read. So
Or tapes.
I listen a lot. I personally learn best by listening rather than by reading. So I listen a lot. I have hundreds. I probably have a few thousand tapes. They're still tapes. Every time I fly, I look in the SkyMall magazine and I think, okay, I just have to get one of those tape to MP3 converters. First, I was looking for a tape to CD converter. Now I'm past that. I've been procrastinating long enough that it's a tape to MP3 converter that I need. And then I have to learn how to use the iPod that my kids gave me, so that I will be able to put it on there, because I'm still listening to what they put on there for me, and actually find it on there. But that's really, yeah, so I listen a lot. And as a young mom, I found I actually, sorry to tell you, had more time than I do now. So I listened a ton as a young mother. I carried a tape recorder around with me, a little one, and I didn't like the headphones because I felt like I was cut off from the rest, but a little tape recorder has better voice sound than big speakers, I found. It's easier to hear. And you carry it around, you're peeling potatoes, you're folding the laundry, you're taking out the garbage. You can listen in 5 minutes here and there, and you can get a lot. It's not the same as listening and taking notes, but you listen to the same thing a few times. So I listened a lot, and then read. And then, of course, now there's internet, so you can look up the specific thing that you want, an article on ish.com that will add something or whatever it is. You know, you can find things around.
And then you just take down the important notes that you want to give out.
This is how I do it, okay? So lamad and limed are two different verb forms, right? Lamad is pa'al, limed is pi'al. It's the same root, though. So what is pa'al to pi'al? I'm not a grammarian, although I do have my BA is in Hebrew language, but it's a joke. So it's just because they hafted me at Hunter College. They wanted somebody to get somebody to major in Hebrew. So lamad is pa'al, that's a soft version, and pi'al is more intensive. Shavar is break. Shiber would be peel, is shatter. Right? Lamad is learn. Limade is teach. How does that, it sounds like it's different. Really, it's the more intensive form of learning. You learn so much that it spills out of you. That's what teaching is. So you have to fill yourself up, and I believe get yourself excited enough about it that it comes out of you. So it's not that you're trying to grab to be able to give. It's that you're trying to fill so that you could overflow. So that's... Right, right. A mashbech. Right. Right. So that's how I try to do it. I try to learn whatever I need to learn to feel comfortable enough to be able to overflow.
Okay, and one more question. If you don't know, someone asks you a very challenging question and you don't know the answer, what's a good response?
That is such a great question. I really wish I knew that. I don't know what to, you know, I'm going to try to find that out. Or I'm still in my journey. Now, that works great for a BT teacher. FFBs maybe are more challenged by that. But I don't think you need to be. You don't have to. Don't put yourself out as somebody who knows everything. You don't. You're still learning and growing. Let's say that is a great question. I don't know. Either, and then don't always commit. You could just end with, that is a great question, I don't know. Because if you say, I'll find out, that means you have to find out and get back to them. And maybe you don't have time for that. So you can just say, that's a great question.
Go look it up.
Go look it up. Or you can give somebody where to look it up. Or where you might look it up. or ask my husband. My husband turns it around. My husband's an attorney, not a rabbi, so he'll, at the Shabbos table, say, that's such an easy question, ask my wife. let me just go back first in the air.
I sometimes use that kind of moment as an opportunity to bring out how infinite the Torah is. Like, I'll say, it is so amazing how vast the Torah is. Like, there's no way that anyone can know everything. You're never done learning. It's so
great.
Amazing.
So that's a great response, right? There's so much to learn. I want to know that, too.
Do you have any ideas of, sometimes I feel like I gather so much information, and I have so much I want to share, and I'm not sure how to bring in those connectors. Like, how do I smoothly go from one thing to the next, and
right.
how do I take out, like,
excellent.
To kind of cut?
That's an excellent question. So here, the question is, you have a lot of information that you want to present. How do you move from one piece to the, how do you make a good segue?
Exactly.
Often a student will help you with a segue. Right? Look, so this question really helps me segue from this into classroom management, into a little bit more of the processing time and preparation. One of the easy mistakes that people make, and this is a very important point that I want to make, is people over-prepare. Right? You're trying to figure out how to balance your life, and you're spending so much time preparing a class that's 4 hours or 6 hours to prepare a one-hour class. You can't do it. It's too much. Right? You have to prepare less, and you have to be really clear about what's your destination. So you're asking me a slightly different question, but the first question, the first answer really is know what you want to give over. Know your destination. So winnow out. There's a lot of important information that you want to share, but I am beginning to learn now that I'm maturing that you don't have to share everything. Not every question needs an answer, and not every piece of information needs to be taught. Right? So you have a certain thing you want to teach, you're not going to teach the whole thing. But I've finally learned how to say, how to not answer a question and just say it's great. Not because I don't even know. Sometimes I know. Why do you cover your hair? Right? But if I give a 5-minute answer to why do you cover hair, that means they're not going to hear the 2-hour shear on it. And they might think that's the answer. So sometimes it's better to leave it as a question. Because you don't want to slack their thirst. You want them to be real, to really feel it and find out more later. It's okay to say, what a great question. There's a lot of background that you need to know in order to appreciate the answer. I'd be happy to do that with you someday. Done. You know, so, okay, so now segues. It really, if you do take the time to prepare, so then you know, kind of know the chunks that you want and you can just segue into them. Often a student will ask you a question. There's the Siyata Dishmaya there too. Or then you just check your notes and you just switch. You know, sometimes it's a little choppier, but that's just practice. You know, just to how comfortable you are with it.
I guess it's more like, you know those classes where, like, they kind of connect and you're bringing, like...
Right, so that is, there's two ways to do that. Right.
You know, this is an idea, and now here's another idea, and here's another idea.
There's two ways to do that, okay? One way is a ton of practice, right, where you just got really used to it and you're good at it after 20 years. The other way is a ton of preparation.
Right, that's preparation.
Where you build a class. I think Lori's going to talk about that a little bit tonight. But her classes are built. I remember once being very surprised when she said, this is the first time I'm speaking about this class, blah, blah, blah. And then the next class she gave, oh, so I don't have it so prepared. She was talking about her kidney donation, the first time she spoke about it in public. So she said, it's the first time I'm speaking about it, so I don't have it really prepared. And I'm thinking, well, prepared, you lived it. Like, do you have to prepare it? But she does, because another class she gave, she said, the architect of this class is, and she attributed, and then I thought, that's so interesting. There was an architect for this class. So a lot of the Aish classes are built, and then they're give over, they're duplicatable. It's like Amway, kind of, right? Mm-hmm. So that somebody else could give that class, Five Levels of Pleasure. That's a class, right? Right. So if you learn that class, you can give that class. But once you've learned that material, you have the segues built in. You have the jokes. They give you the whole thing, right? You're just basically saying their class. So you can do that, too. You just have to be an architect for a class. That's a ton of work. That's a ton of work. I don't think it's necessary. It is necessary in a huge public speaking setting. When I heard Rabbi Fran at AJAP how he gives a class, forget it. He first learns for 20 hours, and then he writes the whole thing out longhand, and then he reviews it, and then he thinks about it, and then he takes scissors and cuts it up, and then he puts it in the computer, and then I'm like, really? That's what you do? Thanks a lot. That didn't help me at all. You know? That's when I listened to Rabbi Berkowitz's tape on Pesach Cleaning Made Easy, and he said, you do not have to clean your telephone with a pin. Simply disassembling it and soaking it in ammonia water is enough. And I'm thinking, that is not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear the reminder that crumbs are not chametz and dirt is not chametz. That's what I wanted. Take apart my phone, right? Didn't help at all. So, yeah. Okay. Classroom management. Okay, let's just go quickly because we are running out of time. Classroom management. The main thing with adult classroom management, and this is why I teach adults and not kids, you have so much self-selection that it's very little classroom management, right?
Well, they're there because they want to be there.
People who are there want to be there. I love teaching adults. They're only there because they want to be there. There is no, like, it's not, I mean, a kid, I don't know how anybody teaches kids. Whoever does, call it kavod. Really. So not me at all. Plus, for me personally, I like the life experience that's inside adults. I don't know how to connect to a sixth grader, an eighth grader, a 12th grader even is barely old enough. Even college students, I do speak to college students, but they're so young that you can't really talk about, like, how do you bring, you know, yeah, there's just not enough life process for them to hear the way I like to speak. But meanwhile, so for teaching adults, classroom management, so you still have problems, okay? So we'll just buzz through them quickly. Talkers, people who like to hear themselves talk, blah, 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 blah. They're busy talking away, and they distract. That's the challenge. All right, Rabbi Becker says at the end of his classes, now you can ask me any question as long as it's not a Jewish question. Everybody laughs, and he says, what's a Jewish question? That's where you speak for 5 minutes, and then sometimes there's a question at the end of that, and sometimes not. Right? So he says, if you have a question now, you can ask a question. So for people who like to talk, you do have to learn it. It's hard at first. Sometimes you let people talk too long. But you do have to learn how to say, that's an interesting point. Let's talk about it after class. But you have to practice some sentences. Sometimes you have to, in hindsight, think about, and this works with parenting too, very important to actually play it out. In hindsight, say, what I should have said was, and then say the sentence out loud. Actually say it. Maybe even stand in front of a mirror and say it. 1 year when I decided that I wasn't going to take on any night obligations that year, except for my regular board meeting and one class I was teaching, that I wasn't going to do anything else, I had to practice saying, this year I am not taking on any additional evening obligations. This year I'm going to be there for my family. It's a good thing I said it out loud a few times. And to practice it, because I knew it would be hard to say no. Somebody called me and said, oh, Lisa, you're so into Kiruv, and I have this great group, and they're meeting Thursday night, and can you please, I know for sure I can count on you, and I had to be able to say, this year, I am not taking on any additional evening obligations. This year, I'm reserving for my family, right? So sometimes you have to practice the sentence when it's hard, a no sentence or a how to shift behavior sentence, and even for your kids, right? How to make it easier for mornings. What's your line about tights, breakfasts, bus fare, whatever it is? You know, how will you say it?
You mentioned the talkers in terms of not getting to the question. Sometimes people aren't able to articulate it quickly enough what it is they're actually getting to. And
yes.
And actually pulling out of there the question that they're asking.
Yes.
Even if they themselves can't articulate it.
Right. So that helps a lot, is to be able to hear what they're asking and to try to cut it off that way and say, so are you asking this? Right? Or sometimes you don't understand their question. Say, can you ask that question in a different way? Right? Can you make it into a question and you can just say, you don't have to say it mean, can you make that into a question that I can answer? You know, or something like that. Because sometimes people don't really, like they are expressing a thought that they're wondering about, but they didn't really quite get to a question about it. So, you know, ask them, can they articulate it as a question? Or you say, are you asking me this? Right? So that's a way too, with something like that. Okay, show-offs. Occasionally you have somebody who wants to, like, show how much they know. And they start telling you different things, right? So you can say, that's a great piece of information. Sometimes you need to, if that's a regular problem, then you'll take them aside afterwards and say, you really appreciate how much learning that they've done. And it's so helpful. If they could write down some of those points to give you notes after the class, you'd really appreciate taking their information into consideration as you prepare the classes. But that you do have a schedule and you have kind of what you're trying to, you know, you have to work with them. But you will have to take them aside. You can't always cut them off in the middle. But and depending on the type of class and if you know them or not, it can be a challenge to have a show-off. Yeah?
Kind of along these lines, do you ever encounter where, like, somebody wants to show the rest of the group how from they are? And how
yes.
They know and if
yes.
Out?
Yeah. Yes. So that's where you want to take them aside. So if they're showing how from they are, you take them aside and say, you know, it's really great that you're here. I'm teaching more beginners. I would love for you to continue with us in the class, but I don't want to scare any of the students who aren't at your level yet. Right? So I ask you to just share your comments with me afterwards. So something like that. But yeah, that definitely happens. And people, especially in the beginning, people need to show, you know, how stark they are, what they've learned, whatever it is. Yeah. Simple. That's hard. When somebody's a little stupid. you know. It is. I know you guys don't watch movies, but some people do. Anyway, there's one scene on a movie that I just saw with, I do watch with some people. My Life in Ruins, right? So she's a tour guide. She's telling everybody they can leave their stuff on the bus. We're going to be locking the bus. Everybody can leave whatever they want, their camera, their water, their money, their sweaters. You can leave anything on the bus because we will be locking it. Any questions before we go? And somebody raises their hand and says, could we leave our sweater on the bus? And I feel like I so often get questions like that. I just like want to say, were you not listening to what I just said? You know, like, I just said that sentence. You know, it's not, this is not even a point. Like, it's exactly what I just said. You know, so it is a challenge to try to, so sometimes you just answer the question, yes, you can leave your sweater on the bus. Okay, right. Moving on. And sometimes it is a challenge if you have somebody who regularly comes to a class. It's more simple, so you just have to make sure you give them information sometimes, but you can't take care of them totally. I don't believe in dumbing down a class to the mean of the class. You have to give something to everybody. So with Hashkafa, you can do that. You know, I used to think that I was good at teaching everybody, and then I realized, no, it's my subject. I like to teach Hashkafa. So few people have a background in Hashkafa that it works for people who don't know much and people who know a lot, because so few people know a lot about Hashkafa. So if that's what you're mainly teaching, you can hit everybody at once. But you do want to be able to hit everybody in the class. You have to look for that simple person and make sure that they feel included, but they can be a challenge. It's not a regular thing. I have one particular class where I have somebody like that, but it's not a regular thing. Where is it written, people? They want to know the sources. But they're not asking where is it written because they want to know the source. They're asking it usually because they're challenging you. Do I really have to do this? Where is it written I can't tear toilet paper on Shabbos? Really, where is that written? You know? So that's really what the question is. That's right. You have to hear the question. So just like as parents, we have to learn to hear the question that's not being asked. That's what this question is. So as a parent, your 5-year-old comes into the kitchen and says, Mommy, can I help you get ready for Shabbos? Right? So you'll say, if you really want to help, go outside and play. But they're not asking you, can I help you? They're saying, Mommy, can I be involved with you? That's their question. So you have to be able to hear what somebody's really asking you. They're not asking you, usually, they're not asking you, where is it written? They're asking, how do I know I really have to do this? Do I really have to do this? I don't feel like doing this. Where is it written? That's really the question. So you have to learn how to hear the question the person's actually asking you. And then, as you get more sophisticated, you have to know which questions you can answer and which questions you can't. Because sometimes people just harp on the same thing. They don't really want an answer. They just want to ask the question because they don't want to move out of that space. So they want to make sure that question stays nice and strong for them. They have to protect themselves from an answer because it would be way too risky to get one. So you have to be able to sense that, too.
How would you respond to that?
How do you get the person to see what they're really asking?
Oh, so the toilet paper one, so then you have to respond by, we have 39 different categories, and they all have their minor categories, and you just have to go through the whole thing. How do you know? And that in every generation, we have to figure out what everything means, and, you know, so, and how you apply it with the technology they have today. So, you know, there's tearing to destroy and tearing to build, and you have to understand, and there's a lot to know to be able to answer that question.
How about people that bring out supposedly orthodox opinions about what are not... acceptable.
Right, so then you can just move around. So what about people who bring up supposedly orthodox opinions that are not acceptable or aren't in alignment with your hashkafa? You can say that's a very interesting point. The way I learned it is. That's all. You just move right on. Right? And so you can maybe discuss it with them later on, but you don't necessarily want to bash anybody. Like, let's say you're not a Soloveitchik person, right? So you don't want to say, and he's way too smart anyway to say this. He understands it differently. Like, I understand it differently than him. Sorry. He's so far above, like, any one of our intellects. But we could say that I learned it this way. Or the way that I was taught it is this way. You know, or in my practice, this is what I do. So you just move it back. You know, or you could say, I'm not familiar with that. Or that's not, or whatever it is. You just have to cut them off in some way. Or say that's not the way that I do it. You can say there's a lot of different opinions within Orthodox belief, and the way that I hold is. And just move on.
That works for acceptable opinions. Mm-hmm. But there are opinions that go under the name of Orthodoxy, which are non-Orthodox.
If it's actually not Orthodox, then don't talk about the person who gave the opinion, because you don't want to start up with that, with bashing anybody or cutting somebody off. Then you can discuss the opinion more. and then show, but you have to be kind of knowledgeable to do that. But you can discuss the opinion more and how that works or doesn't work with what you're trying to show. You know, so like, for instance, somebody will tell me, I'm conservative. I'm a conservative Jew. And I'll say, really? So then we start talking about it. I want to help them see that they're actually an Orthodox Jew, even though they don't practice. So I'll just go through the belief systems. You know, what's the different belief system? If you believe that God exists, the Torah, he gave us the Torah Mount Sinai. The Torah that we have today is the same Torah that he gave us. And he wants us to do what it says in the Torah. You're Orthodox, whether or not you feel like doing all of it. If you believe that God exists, he gave us the Torah Mount Sinai. The Torah that we have today is the Torah that he gave us, and that we need an oral law to go along with it. But we don't actually know what that oral law is, and we're not quite sure, and so we can vote by committee on how you put this into practice. Then you're conservative, right? So most people, especially depending on how you explain it, most people say, well, that's not really how I feel. And some people say, that is how I feel. And you can say, well, that's conservative. Not because you go to a conservative synagogue. That's the conservative philosophy. That's the Orthodox philosophy. So you're a non-practicing Orthodox person. Oh, yeah, I guess I am Orthodox. I just don't practice it. Right? So that's okay. I'm like, I just want people to see they're actually Orthodox. They just don't practice. Pardon?
Do you do that often?
I do, depending on who's talking to me. I mean, depending on the reason, depending on what's going on with them or why they want to identify with one thing or another. But I would go into the philosophy and show how it works or how it doesn't work. And if somebody will say, well, my friend who's very Orthodox bikes to shul, and she says it's okay, right? So then you can say, that's interesting. You could just cut it up and say, that's interesting. That's not how we do it. Or you could say, that's interesting. Is there an Eruv in her area? Or you could just say, and so you could challenge it. That's challenging. Or you could say, my understanding is that biking doesn't necessarily work for a couple of reasons. One would be Eruv, because you're moving something through space. And if there's not an Eruv, then you have a problem with that. But the other problem with a bicycle is that they sometimes can break down. And when they break down, then they become mukta. And most people don't want to abandon their bikes if they become mukta. So we just have a fence around bike riding that we don't ride it in case it would break down and in case we'd come to fix it, which we don't want to do on Shabbos. So for the general population, in most Orthodox circles, bike riding is not something that's looked upon as, but you would have to know that, because there is an opinion that you could if there's an Eruv.
But the thing is that, let's just take that example of bike riding. So this supposedly Orthodox person says, you say whatever your spiel is, and she goes, well, my friend is Orthodox, and she bikes, right? So therefore, there must be an opinion that you can ride a bike.
So then you can say, there are a lot of opinions within the Orthodox camp. And you pretty much have to pick the path that you're on. That's why we have this thing called a Selach HaRav. So everybody has to pick their rabbi and their pathway within the broad Orthodox spectrum and follow that. So if she has somebody she relies upon for that, great. Now sometimes it's wrong what they're saying.
She probably doesn't have someone.
And if she doesn't, that's okay. But then you can say there are, this is hard for people who are Baalei Teshuva or not yet, to actually rely upon somebody, believe in Das Torah, or actually look to somebody, not think that you can look it up yourself. And that's part of the educational process.
Let's just say that happens in a group setting and everyone else is walking away thinking that there is one Orthodox opinion that you can't ride a bike and there is one Orthodox opinion that you can.
So if you're really feeling like that opinion that has just been expressed is going to trafe up the progress of your group or their thinking, then you need to say, I will look into it and get back to you. And then you do have to take responsibility for getting back to them. And then you have to look into it. And then you can say, there is an opinion that hardly anybody holds by, that under these circumstances, a bicycle could be used. But most of us do not, and that's the mainstream view. Or you can say, I looked into it and I found that there was an opinion that is no longer held by. Because sometimes there were opinions. People tell me all the time, when we were young, we never worried about a hechsher. We just read the ingredients. Well, that's true. But how do you explain that in the face of today? Just because somebody who was really from then only went by reading ingredients doesn't mean you can do that today with all the hechshers that are around. So you have to say, that was true at that time, and now what we do is, and we can't do that anymore. So you have to explain that.
Also, some of these conversations, though, they're really just about challenging whether you're going to still have a relationship with them based on whether, you know, like, whether you agree, you disagree, you know, whatever it is. Like, they're not really looking for a response. Like, I had a student who now, she's actually a career professional, it's pretty cool, but she said to me years later, she said, the reason that she kept coming is because she would show up at my house in pants. She was from a firm family, you know, from an Orthodox family. And she would show up at my house in pants. She said, I don't think you ever looked down.
and noticed whether I was wearing pants or not. Never said anything, never had a conversation, wanted to wear a scarf. We just never talked about it. It was just like that. And because she felt so unjudged, it was anything that, you know, or any kind of conversation like this, that would, they would be more challenging. I just kind of...
Right, so it really depends. Really depends. On a one-on-one like that, right. That's fabulous.
So.
And in a classroom situation where somebody might be trafing up ideas, you have to take a little different tack. So it really depends. I just want to get through the end. I'm sorry. Do you have one quick question?
Just a comment. A line that I have heard you, which can deflect, especially in a classroom setting where you don't want to necessarily start getting into the whole discussion, just simply to say, oh, well, I believe that the mainstream post-skim holds like this.
Right. So it really depends.
Mainstream post-skim. Maybe there is
right.
Post-skim, somebody who holds differently, but the mainstream post-skim.
Right.
The mainstream.
And then you have to explain mainstream and all that stuff. Right. So that works. You're going to have to find your own. That will work for some. And some people want to know what is mainstream and what makes them mainstream. Why do we listen to them and not to them? And how can we have opinion? And look, there's all kinds of stuff. Okay. Let's go quickly here. Angry people, so you're going to have to deal with their anger. Sometimes people ask questions out of anger and you can't solve that usually. So you just have to move on. Needy people, also. That's really hard. Right? And in terms of classroom management, because it's hard to manage them in your life. And, in terms of classroom management, you just have to go to the, you know, after class thing where you just stay for a little while, and you just have to have a limit on that. I can stay 10 minutes after class. And then there's the undereducated, the behind, and the ignorant. So for those people, if you're doing a series, you should offer to either talk with them on the phone or come a few minutes before, half an hour, 15 minutes before, to catch them up a little bit. Or just let them know that it's okay. You don't want to say you're undereducated. Just say, you missed a lot of background that we're working with in this class already. So I'm happy to have you join us at this point. But I just want to tell you that some of your questions, and you can ask whatever you want, some of your questions I'll just tell you I'm not going to answer during class because we've already covered that material. Just let the person know. You know, and then you can catch them up or not catch them up or give them resources. Tell them, if you read this, then ask me questions on it later on. Something like that. Okay, processing. Well, now we have to really buzz quickly. Processing. So here's the thing. We have very little time, psychic space, or practice processing. In the marriage class that I gave, I was talking about the development of Bina and how important it is to have the time for Bina to develop and what it is, and that we have to have space and time in our lives for that to grow and develop so that we can have that quality. So we need to make time to think. Time to think is really important. So I gave a whole thing about why we need time to think, blah, 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 and example of when I had thought recently, right? And somebody, so time to think. So somebody raises their hand, and I felt like it was a sweater question, right? She says, what should we think about? I'm like, right. So, like, there's such different paradigms, you know? Like, she was 50, and I'm thinking, man, I have a whole long list of things I want to think about. Should I get the chance? You know, I'm like waiting to stand online or for a red light so I can think about that thing I've been trying to think about. You know, like, I'm just too busy to think about everything, but you have to make time to think. So there's not, people don't practice processing today. Everything is so quick. People don't have the psychic space. Their lives are so full of everything, and they don't have the time. So processing, you have to make time in the class. Especially if you're doing a class, so maybe not if it's a halacha class, but if it's a class on chashbon nefesh before Rosh Hashanah, take out a piece of paper and a pen and let them make a chashbon nefesh right there. Nobody has time to process outside of the class. You know, a few people do. They just don't have time to think about it. So give them time, slow down occasionally, and teach a little less. That's one thing I've learned too. There is this thing we want to be like, you know, Pesach Kron and have a million things with 60 stories backing up every point and then you review at the end with another great story. But but if you do that, people walk out like, wow, that was great. You ask them 10 minutes later, what did he say? And they might not be able to remember a point. You have to give less information and more processing time so that people will come away with something that they can hold on to. That's really important.
Like, practically, where do you put that time into, like, you know, you're just giving a class. You're saying after each point, you're just going to, like, kind of pause. That pause is what you're...
So some of it is talking a little slower.
Okay.
Some of it is taking a breath. And some of it is really thinking about what do I want to share and making sure that you only have maximum 3 main points, but usually 1 or 2 main points that you want to get to. There's a lot of information in this, but my main point is you can do it, so which we're going to get to if I run quickly. One more quick question, or yes or no? Yeah. Not yet.
Okay. I'm just wondering, do you think that it would work in a teleconference series to give people a few minutes to write down a couple of things that they could, you know, do with this information, or do you think that that...
Yeah, I think so. I'm on a teleconference series. I'm in a chabura by phone.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I think that you do it. That's a separate kind of a learning. I notice things that the person who runs the chabura could spend more time with and doesn't, and doesn't need to spend as much time with. It is harder because you're not seeing faces.
Right.
So you don't have that feedback to know how to pace. When are eyes glazing over? When are people getting impatient? You know, you need to know that too. Okay, chavrusa time very quickly. There's a few reasons for a chavrusa time and to decide if you want to put it in or not. One is the actual acquisition of learning skills. You want to teach how to learn. So you'd use chavrusa time for that. One is for acquiring information. You want them to actually make it theirs. When you preach, I don't usually preach in a class. I try to be a guide by the side rather than a sage on the stage, right? Those are two different models of education. If you're a sage on the stage, you're giving information and it just rests on top of people. But if you can be the guide by the side and get them to ask a question, once they've asked a question, they've created space inside themselves to hold that information. Then you can answer the question or help them find the answer, and then it's actually part of them, integrated into them. So chavrusa time can be helpful with actually acquiring the information. And then depending also on the students, can help engage students depending on how you use it. So I'm sorry, I can't go into there too far. Humor, we're going to skip the Hadassah lady joke, sorry. But, So humor, you have to be able to use humor, but humor to make a point. Right, so you don't just start a class with a joke because you start a class with a joke. You use a joke to make a point. So when I start teaching about Olam Haba, and what is it? So I'll start with my Hadassah lady joke, right? So there's 30 Hadassah ladies on the bus driving along. The bus goes off a cliff, and they all die. So now, all together, they go up to the pearly gates. They knock on the gates, and the angel opens the door, and they say, hello, and he says, hello. And they said, where are the Hadassah ladies? And he says, well, I don't have you on my list. And they say, what do you mean we're not on your list? We're the Hadassah ladies. Of course we're on your list. He says, I don't see Hadassah ladies on my list, so I guess you'll have to go downstairs. So down they go. A few minutes later, God buzzes up to the front desk and says, where are the Hadassah ladies? And the angel says, Hadassah ladies? Well, they weren't on the list. And God says, well, didn't you get the revised list? I was expecting a whole busload of Hadassah ladies. Where are they? And the angel says, well, they weren't on the list, so I sent them downstairs. And God says, well, go get them right now. So down he goes, and he speaks to the devil. And he says, I need the Hadassah ladies back up right away. And the devil says, forget about it. They've been here for less than 24 hours, and already they've raised enough money for air conditioning. Okay, so the joke is funny, but it also helps us see heaven and hell. And now I can tell you, we don't believe in heaven and hell. It's a Jewish joke. It totally does not depict what we Jews believe in. We don't believe there's a place. We don't believe there's a devil. We believe in the Satan. So you could tell the joke just to open up about talking about the difference between Satan and devil. And what is that? Or you can use the joke to talk about heaven and hell. And what is that? What is Olam Haba? If we're not going to a place, where are we going? What is it? What's the difference in experience? Why? What? So, but I'm using the joke specifically to open people up. And I use it specifically to paint the wrong picture, but the picture of this society, which is the picture that most people have. Right? And now I can contrast that picture that I just gave them with what the Torah really says about it.
I have that issue a lot. I work with some potential givers, and they have such major obstacles getting over the devil picture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The devil plays such a right. prominent role, and it doesn't in Judaism at
right.
all.
Right, at all. Yeah, it's a very...
I actually called Rabbi Wade in Israel to help me with some guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
He was very helpful.
Very smart. Accessing your resources. Excellent. Okay, outside resources. When do we bring in outside resources? Only to back up our point. I recently went to a lecture where somebody was talking about reincarnation, and he brought a million different stories and points of reincarnation from secular sources, thinking, this is a Rosh Kollel, who obviously doesn't speak very often, thinking that he is going to make certain people really think reincarnation is great. But as I'm watching the whole thing, I'm realizing these kids want to hear about the Jewish point of view. You know, just say, you could bring one thing that says other people also believe in it, but then say, we have a very important belief in reincarnation, and this is what we believe. Don't dilute it with a million other people's thoughts. You don't need that at all. And he didn't get that. He wasted his whole time on other people's thoughts, and the kids in the class didn't walk out with an understanding of what's the Jewish belief on reincarnation. So in his mind, his destination was get them to believe in reincarnation. I think maybe he was processing too much because he was having a hard time with it, but they already believe in it, or they're willing to hear. that it exists and then give them the Jewish belief. So outside sources are only for bolstering your point, and just a quick one. Okay, topics that you choose should be something you're interested, you're drawn to. You have to make it yours, because you have to do that spillover kind of teaching, or it's best to do that spillover kind of teaching, rather than patch, I'm going to put together a class kind of teaching. So it really helps if you're drawn. Daven, we talked about that already. And now the sweatshirt story. Okay, so I sew, right? And I've sewn for a long time. I even went to FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology. But I started sewing a lot before that. I made wedding dresses and baby things and quilts and all kinds of stuff. There's sewing in my family's genes. So one day, I wanted a cardigan sweatshirt. I had a pullover blue sweatshirt, and I wanted to make it into a cute cardigan. So I sewed two lines down the center, cut up the middle, and put a trim that I had chosen on it. And in 20 minutes, I had a sweatshirt where it laid perfectly. It was a cardigan. It's just exactly what I wanted. I cut off the bottom band because I'm a little wide around the bottom, and I wanted it to hang straight and not pull in and make me look fatter. And, like, I knew exactly how to do it. Literally in 20 minutes, it was done. I was so proud of myself. I was standing in front of the mirror. I thought, whoa, look what I did in 20 minutes. And then I realized, no, I did it in 20 years and 20 minutes. Because I knew, first of all, to sew two lines down the center before I cut up the middle, so that would stabilize the edges of the sweatshirt. So when I put the trim on, it would hang just flat and not be curly. And I knew how to put the hem with a double needle on the bottom, so it still looked store-bought, and it fit nicely, and it hung just right, because I had 20 years of sewing experience. So with 20 years of sewing experience, I could use 20 minutes in an afternoon to make a sweatshirt that I wanted. So you have at least 20 years of learning experience. From your elementary school experience to your continuing education, whatever you have a lot of experience inside of you. You don't need to spend 7 or 8 hours preparing for a class. Even if you have less experience, take your life experience and prepare a class in 20 minutes or an hour. You can't give over more information anyway than what you can prepare in 20 minutes or an hour, depending on your subject. If you really want to prepare something for your own learning, that's different. But basically, you should limit yourself to around an hour to prepare for a class, or less. If you're preparing it from a text, it could be less, right? An hour should be enough, because you have a whole life. So make it like a sweatshirt, right? Take your life experience. Add a little time onto it to organize your life experience. Figure out where you're missing a piece of information for the point that you want to make. Learn that piece of information. And then give your class. Don't bog yourself down in hours and hours and hours of preparation so that you are teaching less. But still learn for your own self so that you have what to draw on. Continue filling your well. But give yourself some credit for what you already know. And find things that you love to learn and enjoy it. Relax. That's a blast. Once you start, I love learning and I love teaching. And I mainly love it because I love learning. So I love sharing what I'm learning. So with that, we'll end this class, and you can ask any questions afterwards.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Pleasure. What would you recommend?